This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to Jennifer Weiner's The Next Best Thing and help keep this wonderful show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook, a 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes you need more in life than a pair of thumbs to keep your eight fingers busy. Okay, so I'm here once again with Jennifer Weiner, who is most recently the author of
The Next Best Thing.
I was going to do the dramatic pause, but you couldn't. Wait, I couldn't jump in.
Wow. I jumped right in. Right.
Okay, I'm sorry. So should I have you ask the questions and all the shit, but and you could do the answers and all that?
I'm ready.
How are you doing?
I'm really good. The heat has broken. It's no longer unbearable out there.
I was shocked.
I know. And like, I'm basically like rolling with my sister and my assistant. So it's like this moving sort of slumber party.
Well, wait, so what is the size of your entourage now?
Well,
I want to know.
Right now we have two. We're just two.
West Coast and East Coast?
Yes, my sister's from the West Coast. Megan, my assistant, is from the East Coast. But like last week, I was in Cape Cod with like my mom and her partner and my half brother and my sister and my babysitter. And so like we just had the whole schmear.
Yeah,
it was fantastic.
Oh wow, the whole schmear.
It takes a lot of
basically
people.
Your tour is like a bagel, basically.
It basically is. It's a bagel with a lot on it.
Circular.
It takes a lot to make this happen.
Yeah,
it does.
Well, anyway, let's get to something more important. It's interesting to me in this book that you have your protagonist, Ruth Saunders. I mean, she is physically scarred.
Yes.
One of the book's two Daves, he gets around in the wheelchair.
Yes.
So this seems a very curiously literal foreshadowing of what Ruth later reads out of Julia Phillips, you know, this whole idea of the essentially broken people who work in the entertainment industry.
Yes.
I have to ask you about this.
Yes.
Must one be lacerated or severely maimed in order to survive or become a Hollywood success? I mean, was this a way of establishing a sufficient physical bona fide so that you can go ahead and drag out the knife? What happened?
I had a lunch with a comedy writer in Hollywood who called Hollywood the land of misfit toys.
Yeah.
He said, everyone here is broken. And I thought, okay, let's make that literal. Let's have some literally broken people.
Yeah.
Because the way most people are broken, they look okay. Like, you see them on the street, you wouldn't know that anything is wrong. But it's a lot of gay guys and formerly fat girls.
Yeah.
So people who were really unhappy as young, when they were in their formative years.
Yeah.
And have taken that unhappiness and transmuted it to comedy. But they are, it's the walking wounded out there.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I fit in great.
You're wounded?
You're
still wounded?
I'm wounded and I'm walking.
how wounded are you these days? I mean,
no.
why do you need these, again, with this physical frailty or enlargement or laceration? I mean, it seems to me that you need to establish the physicality before you get to the emotional underpinning. So how does that work here?
How
does it work with this book?
With this book, I wanted a character who couldn't fix herself. Fat girls can lose weight, okay? And I think that a lot of damaged people can present themselves as perfectly normal. I wanted to write about a woman who could never pass.
Yeah.
You know, there used to be a lot of talk about black people who were light-skinned enough to pass.
Yes.
Ruth can't pass as normal. She can't fix what's wrong. She's had a lot of surgeries. This is Ruth Saunders, who's the heroine of The Next Best Thing, who is in a car accident when she's three. Her parents die. She's thrown through a windshield and is just horribly disfigured.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write about a damaged person. I think I always write about damaged people, but with Ruth especially, she can't fix what's wrong, and I wanted to give her a happy ending anyhow.
Yeah. Well, the notion of the writer's room depicted in The Next Best Thing as this sort of great therapy session.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I have to obviously ask a few parallels between your particular experience in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating to me that one must mine the entirety of one's autobiography in order to function and come up with story ideas, and then if your show gets canceled, people have that.
Absolutely.
They walk away with that. So,
yeah.
So what is this like just from your own experience, and how did this translate into Ruth's experience in this particular book?
Well, I used a lot of what happened in my writer's room in this book. I mean, I think, I believe that if you're a writer and things happen to you, funny things, tragic things, terrible things, wonderful things. If you don't use them, like, that is an affront to God, basically. Like, really? I think that...
So you would use anything?
I'd use almost it. I'd use a lot. I would use a lot of it. Because I think that, like, you know, for instance, like, something I've talked and written about a lot is sort of when your mom comes out of the closet at 54.
Yeah, of course.
You gotta write about that. It's so funny and weird and sad and strange and hilarious that you have to use it.
But isn't it a writer's duty to make shit up? I think that's the official industry term for it. Clearly you are not scarred, but you could actually do some parallel experience and resort to that. So, you know, where does the line between what you personally experience and what you recreate or mimic or wish to explore?
Well,
how do you define that?
I mean, I think that what you have to do, this is for me, what I have to do, okay, you take the raw material, which is your own life, and then you exaggerate it. You make it more funny or more poignant or more painful or more real somehow. I mean, I remember years and years ago, like my first book ever, like writing this, what was to me this incredibly wrenching scene about a young woman and her father. Yep. And it had happened to me. I mean, my dad had called me ugly. And it was just the most devastating thing for a girl. And I remember turning it into my editor, and she was just like, you know, this isn't working. And I'm like, how can it not be working? It happened.
Yeah.
It happened to me.
Yeah.
And she's like, you know, that's for you and your therapist. But for the reading public, like, this isn't working on the page. It's not helping the story. It's not earning its place on the page. So I think that for everything, every piece of raw material, you've got to work it like a sculptor works clay. You've got to mold it, shape it, carve it, chip it, polish it, get it to the point where it's working on the page.
This leads me to ask you, I mean, this is a common predicament that many writers almost lifting one's personal experience and putting it directly into the novel. The importance here is to make the reader believe.
Yes.
Not necessarily to go ahead and journal lies.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And truth is sometimes the least believable thing on the page.
Yeah.
I mean, I have stories from my life that I tell people, and they're like, there is no way you could ever put that in a novel. No one would believe it.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
But what do you do? I mean, have there been any instances of stories that you have tried to sandwich, I suppose, into a novel that have just not worked out, that you've had to drop, that you have sort of said, oh, God, I can't make this work? Have you made repeated efforts to try to cram them in?
Do you still,
to this very day after 10 books?
I think I've learned a little better. You know, the thing that I tell young writers is just because it happened to you doesn't mean anyone else is going to care.
Yeah.
It's a hard lesson to learn, because I think that writers, you know, we're all precious little snowflakes, and we all believe that, you know, if it happened to us, it has deep resonance and meaning and universal truth, and that's just not always the case.
I have to ask, did you actually fight a network brass over the word ass much?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Really?
I did.
And there was this kind of exchange of viewpoints that ass munch was just unacceptable, even though I hear 12-year-olds say ass munch all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's like they said blowjob on NYPD Blue, and I can't have an ass munch, and they're like, we're ABC Family, and I'm like, you're a different kind of family. It says so right on your logo.
Yes.
I want my ass munch.
Yes.
And I was denied.
What other words did they deny you during this time?
You know, it wasn't words as much as people. The part about not seriously, the part about not being able to make jokes about Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
I guess she's both very sensitive and very litigious.
So that actually happened too.
That happened too.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Were there any other public figures who were declared verboten?
No. No,
Just Barbara.
But we weren't, well, you know, the funny thing was we had this line about Bruce Jenner.
Yeah.
And Aunt Honey, who is sort of the anti-Mame character, is like, now you girls probably just know him as the crazy old lady in the Kardashian house. And I was like, oh my God, like, Standards and Practice is never going to let this go.
Yeah.
I guess Bruce Jenner got the joke.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, we approached him to, like, play the part, you know, to, like, come down the stairs as if he'd been in bed with Aunt Honey.
Going from these battles with Standards and Practice back to fiction writing,
yes.
I have to ask, I mean, especially in light of the one percenter joke idea, which, oddly enough, with your recent Eugenides Vest campaign,
I hope we talk about that.
Well, we can. Yeah, I'm happy to. But it is interesting to me that, you know, you come from television,
Yep.
You basically your foot is laid down for things like ass munch, for esoteric references or seemingly esoteric references.
Yes, the one percenters.
How do you unlearn some of these necessary exigencies when you're writing, when you come back to fiction?
Yeah.
I have to ask you about this because, I mean, when you're, especially in such an intense showbiz environment, having
right.
to produce and having to fight and having to compromise and having to go ahead and create art in a very, you know, highly commercial medium, how do you go to, I suppose, a slightly less commercial medium like books and,
right.
and be true to that voice that established you in the first place?
For whatever reason, I didn't have a hard time with it. I don't know if that's sort of just a way that I'm lucky,
yeah.
but I didn't have a hard time going from the very, like you said, the very mediated world of commercial TV to the world of novels where it's just you and the people in your head and we'll see you in a year with that manuscript.
Yeah.
You know, it wound up being okay. But God, I loved being in a writer's room.
Yeah.
I miss it every day.
You want to go back to a writer's room?
I would like to go back to a writer's room someday. It would be different, I think. But
even
like,
with the battles?
Even with the battles, because I think that there's cases that it goes so right, you know, and the stars kind of align. And then I also think there's different ways of doing entertainment, like Louis C.K.,
yeah.
where it's basically like, okay, network, you give me X number of dollars, I will give you Y number of shows, and no notes.
But that's a very uncommon situation.
It doesn't happen
to everyone. Even you probably mm-hmm. couldn't get what he has.
Well, but then there's people doing stuff on the web.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, you know, I don't want a network. I don't want notes. I don't need your money. I'm going to kickstart this thing or raise money myself. And
yeah.
just it'll be my vision unmitigated. That's what I think we're going to start seeing more of, because I think that there's going to be increasing frustration with, you can't say that. You can't say that about that person. You
yeah.
can't use those words.
Yeah.
We want you to do it with this actress. And that to me was the hardest part, was I went out there, I wanted to do a show about a big girl.
Yeah.
And the network, ABC Family, had a holding deal with Raven Simone.
Yeah.
Who, during That's So Raven, had been a bigger girl.
Yes.
And I'm like,
also put into the novel.
Yes.
Too.
And I'm like, okay, fantastic. That's great. I mean, I guess she won't be Jewish, but we'll deal with that. You know, and then I'm like, I want to sit down and meet with her and talk about the part and talk about how she relates to the character and where the character comes from. And they're like, she's busy, she's traveling, she's on vacation. And
so she really would not meet with you?
Would not meet with us. And
wow.
I remember thinking, you know, they kept saying she's on vacation. And I'm like, on vacation from what?
Why didn't you just track her down yourself?
She was in Hawaii.
She was in Hawaii. Why not fly on a plane out of Hawaii and say, Raven, what's
in
up?
In retrospect.
Romana Clay, it sounds like.
It is a little, well.
But did she follow you on Twitter?
I don't think she did.
She did not.
I don't think she followed me on Twitter.
Wow.
I gave her a bunch of my books. I'm not sure she read them.
Did she overact, as you suggest, this particular?
I think, no.
I know you have to be careful here.
Yeah, but no, I actually think she's got great comic chops.
Yeah.
I think that she grew up in front of a camera. I mean, this is a girl who shot her first commercial at age 9 months.
Yeah.
She's been a working actress longer than, you know, she's been a working actress for her whole life, basically, which produces its own kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting dynamic where you've got a child supporting parents.
Yes.
And that's a whole nother book.
But going back to this issue of, well, you couldn't meet with her. I mean,
yeah.
this has got to be extremely frustrating for
yes,
you.
Right.
Speaking as someone who, you know, is largely on the literary field and sometimes goes into independent film and so forth,
right.
you know, this has got to be, from my vantage point at least, an extremely creatively frustrating experience.
Well,
you know, what does television offer
yeah.
that fiction does not?
Well, you know what it offers, I'll tell you, is an audience. Because the absolute...
You've got an audience, though.
But listen, the absolute best-selling novel, like, in its first week will sell, say, 500,000 copies.
Yeah.
Okay, that is how many people will tune into the lowest-rated rerun of a Kardashian show.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk to young
women...
Which is frightening and sad. But if you want to talk to young women, you go be on TV.
If you want to talk to young women. Why do you need that large audience?
I want to talk to young women. I mean, I remember watching TV as a young woman, and there was never anybody who looked like me unless she was the butt of the joke
yeah.
or the funny best friend or, you know, somebody tragic, somebody who needed a makeover in order for good things to happen. And I have daughters.
Yeah.
And they're both like blonde hair, blue eyed. They're very cute little girls. I've basically given birth to my own unit of the Hitler Youth. I don't get it. But I want to make shows for girls where the heroine doesn't look like Blake Lively, where it's like the heroine looks like a regular girl and still gets everything, gets the guy, gets the jokes, gets the great clothes, gets the great job. That's what I went out there to do.
Well, Jen, I'm all for creative idealism as much as the next person. I mean, this program prides itself on its creative control.
Mm-hmm.
However,
mm-hmm.
you know, you got
I went to the
Raven.
Wrong place,
yeah.
maybe.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I got Raven minus 30 pounds.
You really can't always get what you want when it comes to television. So, I mean, it seems to me that wouldn't you be better off? You know, you can do pretty much whatever you want. I'm thinking
in a book
that yep. you can't do with television. So
you know, I hope though. I mean, and I think I'm going to keep sort of banging at that door because I do think you look at a show like Girls on HBO,
yeah, which
where,
I'm a big fan of. Oddly
right,
enough, I never expected to say that.
Yeah, but I think that there are people on networks that would be like, well, no, we don't want people that look like that on TV. We have to sell Bally Fitness commercials.
Yeah.
Well, HBO does not have to sell Bally Fitness commercials. They
no.
just have to have subscribers.
They also don't need that great of an audience, which
exactly.
is why they can have the shows that
right.
they do.
They can have a hit if 500,000 people watch,
yeah.
where a network, you'd be canceled before you
sure.
got to the first commercial. So there's places it can happen. There's ways that it can happen. And I'm going to keep, you know, I would like to keep trying.
You have very skillfully evaded my main question, which was
yes.
you have an audience.
I do.
You have a great audience.
They love me.
You have an audience of girls and young women and
mm-hmm.
women. And,
mm-hmm.
and I'm saying to myself, well, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Why isn't that enough?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Nice media training there, Jen.
You know what? I think that I'm someone who's wired to want more.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Because maybe it's daddy stuff. I don't know. But I see gaps and problems and imbalance and inequity.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, feel compelled to talk about it. You know, whether
yeah.
it's the New York Times not covering women, whether it's
we'll
get to that, whether it's television offering a range of beauty that goes from a size 0 all the way up to a size 2. And it's like, well, maybe I can do something about that. And I feel like I need to try.
Yeah. But it seems to me that you're reflecting some sort of personal imbalance
mm-hmm.
and stretching it into some sort of societal imbalance, but creating yet another form of imbalance.
Uh-huh.
I mean, why isn't the work itself
uh-huh.
enough? Because you can always stretch yourself on that canvas.
Yep.
You could always try new things on the page.
But again, who's reading? I mean,
I'm reading.
I mean, but
you have millions of people reading your work.
I don't know if 14-year-old girls are, I think they're reading Twilight, and that concerns me some.
They're also reading, you know, I mean, China Miéville. He keeps writing YA
this
books.
Is true.
And he writes his literary books.
This
you
is
could
true.
Do something like, why
okay.
not write a YA book?
I'm actually working on a YA book. Yes. Thank
okay.
you for asking.
Yeah.
I'm writing. You remember Pippi Longstocking?
Yes.
Okay. So like 10-year-old girl who's like living alone with a monkey named Mr. Jingles.
Absolutely.
And I remember reading that and loving it because she has these adventures and she's kind of an ass kicker. Like she's got huge feet and she sort of takes on the mean boys. And I'm like, I read it as a girl and loved it. I read it as a mom to my daughter, and I'm like, this is the most fucked up thing I've ever seen in my life. Why is this child living by herself with a monkey?
Yeah.
Like, what the, you know? So what I'm writing is a story about a girl who comes home from school one day and discovers her parents are missing. They're just gone.
Yeah.
And she doesn't tell anybody because she knows that the instant people realize her parents aren't there, she's going to be shipped off to her horrible aunt in Texas. And she sort of scams her way through a school year and figures out all of these tricks. My favorite one is she signs up for a diet service to deliver all her food. She doesn't know how to cook. So she's like, she sees an ad on late night TV, like, we'll bring you 3 meals and 2 snacks every day. So she calls up and she's like, it's for my mom. I want to surprise her. And the lady's like, oh, honey, that's so sweet. You know, like, how big is your mom? And like, so she makes up the biggest number she can think of. So she'll get a lot of food.
Yeah.
So it's a, you know, so I am interested in thinking about YA and thinking about reaching an audience that way. But I think television just offers, like, it's a great canvas to tell a story. It gives you space. It gives you time. It gives you visibility. I mean, I think that books...
Well, you've got visibility. You've got time.
No.
The book, I mean, you're going to spend more time working on a book than working on a TV series, I would think. I mean, you know, that's a massive undertaking.
It is. It is. I mean, I don't know how objective I can be about myself. I don't know how objective anyone can be about herself. But there's something about me that, like, I like new challenges.
Yeah,
I liked learning new things.
Sure.
I liked realizing what I was good at and what I was not good at. Like, I'm good in an editing room. I am not good managing people. It is not part of my skill set.
You join a wonderful group of people such as Dan Harmon.
Uh-huh.
I know, exactly.
It's like, I'm a good writer, but God help me, I cannot talk to actors. It's like, somebody tried to explain to me, just like, take their age and subtract 10 years.
Yeah.
And see if that works. So I'm like, okay, I have an actor who's 25. Let me see if I treat her like a 15-year-old. Is that going to make things any better? And it kind of did a little.
Wow. But having to deal with adults and pretend they're teenagers.
I know.
You don't necessarily have to do that in the literary world.
I mean, you sure don't.
To some degree, you don't have to do that.
Well, no. Yeah. I mean, I am lucky with my fiction world. I've had the same agent. I've had the same editor. I've had the same publisher for 10 books, 12 years. Couldn't be happier. I'm treated wonderfully.
Couldn't be happier.
And yet you want more. And yet I want more.
I mean, see, this is what I mean. A lot of writers would look to someone like you and say, you know, what does she have to complain about? Mm-hmm. And in fact, they have said that.
And less politely.
I'm trying to be very polite. I've been trying to understand this impulse with you.
Uh-huh.
This is the fourth conversation I've done.
I know.
And I've been trying. And you always skirt out of it. You've got to lay a little on the line.
All right,
Why do you want more? Why isn't what you have enough? It's very clear.
Yep.
You're going to have haters.
Yep.
Every artist, no matter how successful they are, I don't care if you're Jen Weiner or the Beatles or whatnot, someone's going to hate. So why does that matter so much?
I don't know if it's the haters that matter so much. The thing with the times...
Oh, really?
No, I don't. It's not that so much. I mean... The article in Tablet about not being Jewish
Alice
enough,
Gregor, yes.
That hurt. That was like, that was an owie. That was. But, you know.
This has not exactly been a cheery and friction-free conversation.
I
don't know.
No, I'm fine. But, like, honestly, I think it's probably daddy stuff. I think, like, a lot of women who grew up being told by fathers that they were not sufficient, either not sufficiently pretty or not sufficiently talented or not sufficiently... literary. I mean, my father, I grew up not being allowed to watch TV because my dad said it was trash.
This is why you're a bachelorette junkie.
it may well be. But I just know that my father, were he still alive, would probably look at a book like mine, look at a book like Good in Bed and be like, ugh, trash. Trash.
But you're well far from that now in terms of, you know, a daddy complex.
Well,
I mean, I don't know if women ever
get over it. I think you carry your dad with you wherever you go. I think Sylvia Plath wrote some poems about it.
Yes, that's true. Mm. Actually, well, while we're on the subject, I'm going to offer a minor little point here.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that with some of your more recent work, the material specifically after Then Came You, you've been straying from characters who were besieged by financial problems. Ruth Saunders, she lives with her grandmother.
Yes, she does.
Georgia and Joe in State of Georgia, which I did watch a number of those episodes.
Uh-huh,
They work at a perfume counter.
Yes,
But they still have Aunt Honey.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I have to ask, you know, why are so many of your more recent characters cushioned by money? I mean,
it's
you know,
this question.
Is a far cry from Jules or Annie. In They Came, Then Came You.
And then Came You.
Yeah,
well,
and I don't want this. I think is a more legitimate criticism, but it is one worth handling because are you trying to give more of a fantasy to your audience? This is a very curious choice, especially in light of the fact that unemployment is a big problem for a lot of people right now.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I do think with Then Came You. That book, I wanted to specifically take on the criticism that Chick Lit doesn't deal with money.
Yeah.
That Chick Lit deals with wealthy women, buying shoes, husband hunting. I wanted to write about women who are struggling.
Yeah.
With The Next Best Thing, I wanted to write about a woman in Hollywood. And the truth is, once you get that job in a writer's room, you're going to be making good money.
Sure.
You just are.
Sure.
So I think with the next book, I think that I may go back to sort of somebody with financial woes.
Yeah.
Because I'm very invested in that aspect of the world. And it's interesting because I watch what other writers do, not only in their books, but like in their public personae. Yeah. Like if you go to another writer's Facebook page and it's like, here is my multi-million dollar mansion that I've just redecorated. Take a video tour. And I'm thinking, how do her readers feel about this as they struggle to pay their mortgages? Do they want to see like the $3 million Greenwich mansion that she just redid? Or, you know, I sort of feel that my audience relates to me because I feel like them. Like, yeah. And they feel like me. And
even though there's a marked income disparity.
There is a marked income disparity, but I don't like to talk about it.
Yeah.
And I don't ever in social media. Like, I'm super duper careful. Mostly for reasons of privacy. I don't post pictures of my children. I don't talk about my personal life. I would never post a picture of my house. I don't talk about vacations. I just feel like it's A, it's nobody's business, but B, I don't want to emphasize that there's a gap between the life that I'm living and the characters that I'm creating. And certainly anybody who thinks about it
yeah.
is going to realize, like, if you sell X number of books, then probably you've made some money.
Yeah.
And probably you're living nicely, but...
But a number of your less snobby readers, or people mm-hmm. who, like me, who I'll read Jen Wiener, I'll read Teju Cole, I'll mm-hmm. read Stephen King, mm-hmm. I'll read whoever. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it just has got to be good.
Yes.
You know, I asked this question about money because you have always been very good about behavior, and when you get into questions of affluence, you do open yourself up to these needless chiclet criticisms.
Right.
And then I, as someone who has in fact seen how you have depicted behavior, mm-hmm. I then have to sort of side with them and say to myself, well, you know, I don't understand why she's going for the more fantastical approach when she's very good mm-hmm. at showing how people tick. And I'm going to even offer an example from the next best thing. So you have this moment early in the book where Ruth is dating this teacher named Gary, right?
Yeah, right.
And it's very clear that you were about to unload this income gender gap issue.
Yeah.
And I was like reading this going, oh, wow, she's totally going to do it, right? Mm-hmm, but no. Mm-hmm. What does Gary do? He offers another sort of like typical anti-corporate rant, but he doesn't actually say, you know, you earn more money than I do. And I have to say, I have to call you on this. You know, why back off from that very, very impeccable behavioral moment?
I don't know that there's a guy alive who would actually say to a girl, I'm breaking up with you because you're making more money than I am,
yeah.
and it's making me insecure.
Yeah.
They think that and they feel it.
Yeah.
And I think that any woman who makes money has seen this play out in
yes.
her personal life.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if a guy would say it. Do you think a guy would?
Or he wouldn't say that explicitly, but he would certainly behave in a more explicit manner. I've seen because unemployed men, especially like among freelancers, especially if they are attached to women. I mean, often it is the women who are earning the money, who are floating them by, and they're hoping to, you know, land a job somewhere down the line. And it can often be a very tense situation, especially for a man who is not especially enlightened, not especially comfortable, or used to being the breadwinner.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's a tricky, painful dynamic. And I think that I dealt with it, and then came you with Annie and Frank,
sure.
where... You know, Annie wants desperately to contribute somehow to her family's income. She's home with two young boys, and she can't work, really. But she's thinking, I can carry a baby for someone. I can earn some money that way.
Yes.
Never realizing the way that is going to unman her husband.
Yes.
The way that having a wife walking around pregnant with someone else's baby is going to devastate him.
Yes. Which
so,
is
yeah.
I use that as an example in this last question, which is uh-huh. why I have to call you on Ruth and Gary.
Uh-huh.
Why can't you find a way to work that in with this? Or is
uh-huh.
it really kind of as USA Today, an unfavorable review today, said, well, she's working out her problems or
working
something.
Working out my problems. Like, I don't pay my therapist enough for that. You know, it's interesting because I do think that it's there implicitly, but I just couldn't imagine Gary, who's a good guy.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine him saying to Ruth, you know what? You're making too much money for me.
Yeah.
And I can't handle it. I don't think a guy would say that. I think he'd behave that way.
Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, why not have him behave more than just an anti-corporate speech, which, you know.
Yeah, you wanted it to be more
of
a jerk.
No, because then Ruth is forced to come to terms with, oh, holy shit, I'm actually making more money than. I don't think she actually realizes that.
See, I think she did.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go back and look at that again, because I think, in my mind, it was clear that, you know, he's sort of giving the socialist rant.
Yeah.
But what it really comes down to is he can't handle the status gap.
Sure.
And I should have maybe made that more clear.
Okay, well, fair enough. Hollywood sacred texts. You have Ruth name-checking Julia Phillips. But it's Ruth's grandmother who brings up William Goldman.
Yes, she does.
Which,
one knows anything.
Nobody knows anything. I was sort of surprised. I thought Ruth would be savvy enough to actually know that. So why is that?
I imagine Ruth has heard that a time or two before, along with it's not show friends, it's show business.
Exactly.
Ouch. I think that that's true out in Hollywood. I think nobody does know anything. And
yeah.
I think that there, you can look at shows that are huge successes and shake your head and wonder why. Certainly there are shows that are huge successes that I don't know why anyone would ever waste 22 minutes. There's shows that make me incredibly uncomfortable to watch that the guys I know love. Like the Larry Sanders Show, I can't watch it. It makes me cringe. And guys love it. Every guy I know loves that.
But I haven't seen it in years.
Okay.
I mean, you know, it's been a number of years since I saw it.
Or like the Gary Shandling Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Okay.
Well, but I saw that like decades ago. Yeah.
Guys love that.
I know. I did. I liked it when I was younger. But I don't know how I would react now.
And it's interesting. Like, I think, like, guy, there's a brand of comedy that men respond to and women don't.
Well, like such as what are we talking here?
Let me give an example. It's not going to piss anybody off.
No, you can piss people off.
Let me think for a minute.
I could try to sort of mollify whatever.
No, I'm trying to think. Like, what's a show? Well, I don't know. Let me do the reverse. Game of Thrones. Like, do you remember when Genia Belafonte said no woman would ever watch this? Like, swords and shields.
Quite frankly, I've seen a few episodes of Game of Thrones and it bores the hell out of me.
I love it.
Wow.
Love,
wow.
Love, 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 love. Yeah. And just the idea that, and then her sort of half-assed, well, maybe women do watch this, but I don't know any women who do. And it was like, well, okay, so that's how we're doing reporting these days? It's like people I know, like that's, it was all very weird.
Well, wait, so wait, this gender gap in television
yes.
shows.
Yes, let me think.
I mean, yeah.
Ask the question again.
Okay, the question is, what specific strains of gender-based comedy are we talking about here? That's what I was curious about.
Yeah, okay. So, the Larry Sand... Larry, what am I... I'm getting it wrong.
You mean Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
No, I,
thank
I, yeah,
you.
Yeah,
okay, I cringe.
Oh, yeah, but it's cringe comedy.
I know. Cringe comedy. Men can handle it.
Oh, I love it.
I can't. I can't watch.
Well, see, that's the whole thing. You're being pushed to an emotional limit. Have you ever heard of a show called Peep Show in the UK?
No, I don't know that.
Oh, my God. You want to talk about cringe comedy. And it's hilarious. Oh,
right.
You have to see it.
I'll try.
Yeah,
you will try.
I will try.
But I'll tell you the other funny thing about USA Today. Like, I didn't read the review because I just try to stay away.
Yeah,
because.
Of course.
But the woman was just like, I gather the point was she liked my first two books better, right?
Yeah.
USA Today gave a really mixed review to Good in Bed and trashed In Her Shoes. So I'm like, well, why can't I have that reviewer
Again,
review this book?
This goes back to the question, line of questions earlier.
Haters.
Why should
haters.
The haters matter? Why should these people matter? Why do you care so much?
I don't know. It's a good question. Why do I? What do you think?
Well, you can't please everybody. I mean, I have said this like repeatedly. Jen, you cannot please everybody.
You sure can't.
And we come back. And
yep.
I suspect that if I were to ask you that question in 5 or 10 years, you would give me the exact same answer.
I'm not getting any clarity.
No, I mean, it's just like...
I need a different therapist?
No. like David Mitchell, for example, right? Who this program is named after.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't read any reviews, and right? He did this after Cloud Atlas. There's no sense in reading the reviews because people, one, if they like your book, mm-hmm. they're not going to get it right. Yep. We were discussing before the tape was rolling that Janet Maslin has been having this difficulty of getting her factual details right, her character names right.
It's
so what's the point in caring about that?
You know, there probably isn't one. And I don't read my reviews. Like, I've learned...
Although you're very familiar with them.
I'm isn't that funny?
Yeah.
No, you know, the USA Today thing, my agent sent it to me. She sent me a redacted version.
Redacted?
She sent me the nice stuff. I've wow. trained my people well.
It's like the Pentagon Papers.
I know. Isn't it right? It's like XXX. And I'm like, what does that say? No. But I mean, honestly, like I don't have Google alerts on myself. I don't read reviews. I didn't read the tablet piece. One of my like super Jewy friends told me about it.
Yeah.
And you're right. You can't please everyone. I try to let it go. But the way I'm wired is the way I'm wired. And I think a lot of writers are this way,
yeah.
where maybe it's especially a female writer thing, where...
Well, that's like a gender generalization, don't you think?
Except I think women are trained to please. We are. We're trained to make people happy. We are trained to not get in the way and to appease and to smooth out conflict and to be kind.
Yeah.
And the qualities that are prized in men, like ambition, and...
I'd say you've got ambition.
I would say I have ambition too, but ambition's an insult sometimes when you're talking about women.
I don't call it. I don't view it as an insult.
You don't.
In fact, I would challenge you to even be more ambitious.
Well, I would. Okay, yeah. You've been wanting me to write my science fiction thing.
Not
forever.
Only that, no. I want you to write like you could write. I think I know you have it. You could write like a 600-page. Massive literary like Tolstoy. Who would read it? Are you you really believe that if you were to go ahead and instead say like spend 2 or 3 years on right. a massive mm-hmm. literary masterpiece, mm-hmm. you honestly believe you would lose your audience?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's going to be very interesting to me to see what happens with Emily Giffen this summer.
Mm-hmm.
She's taken 2 years off between books, and I want to see if her audience stays with her. Jane Green took 2 years off between yeah. books, and the book didn't do great.
Yeah.
So I'm interested to see.
You really believe that your audience wouldn't follow?
I don't know. But the thing is, like, I'm such a presence on Twitter.
My mouth is dropping here.
What do you think?
I think people would totally go with you. You've had people go with you for 10 books.
10 books.
That's a really good, solid track record.
Uh-huh.
There would not be so much of a drop-off. Look at Laura Lippman, for example.
Yes.
She actually started writing books at a less frequent rate, and her audience followed her.
Well, now, didn't the Tess Monahan books come out once a year, though?
They did once a year, and then she sort of dropped off and was doing more like once every 18 months. And
yeah.
then, like, you got guys like Christopher Moore who have this deal where they do... they spend like 18 months on one and 6 months on another.
Right.
I mean, you could do something like that, I suppose.
I could. But then there's Lisa Scottolini, who's now doing a memoir and a novel every year.
Yeah.
I think for every person who's sort of like, I'm taking 3 years to write my opus, there's somebody who's like, I'm writing 3 books a year
yeah.
and 2 Kindle shorts and graffiti.
Well, this leads me to wonder. I mean, it's like 6 to 9 months for a book from
mm-hmm.
start to finish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have you thought of like slowing that cycle down?
I think that this is the year I'm going to.
Really?
I do, yeah.
The YA book or something else?
My publicist just perked up. No, I'm in the middle. The next best thing was book 2 of a 4-year contract.
Yeah.
A 4-book contract, and I have written in there that I can take 2 years to write a book. And what I would love to do is the sort of generational saga that Susan Isaacs did,
yes.
where it's sort of, you know, it's the woman in the 1920s, the woman in the 1940s, the woman in the 1960s.
Yeah.
That would be fun for me, I think. And now that both of my daughters are in school full days,
that's the big
that's what I was waiting for.
Yeah.
So now I've got some time.
So you could see yourself doing this generational epic.
I would love to do a generational thing. I would love to do a dystopia thing. I've been playing with this thing forever about a world where adult women can't conceive and 6-year-olds can have babies.
But wouldn't you rather have the, quote, epithet ambitious mm-hmm. attached to you rather than, oh, well, Jen's a loudmouth. She's going to go ahead and go on Twitter and say this and that and complain about this and complain about that. I mean, wouldn't it be better just to like have ambitious Jennifer Ambitious Weiner instead of ambitious. Jennifer Loudmouth Weiner or something?
You know what, though? I think ambition is an insult to a lot of people still.
It's not an insult to you?
Well, I've seen ambition used in different ways, and I think that...
We're not talking Macbeth.
I'm not planning on killing anybody that I'll tell you about. No. I mean, I do. I want to write the best books I can, and I think if that means maybe taking a little more time with the next one, that's what'll happen.
Yeah.
But I do think that if you look at things like productivity... And the way that, like, a Joyce Carol Oates gets written about versus a John Updike or a Philip Roth. Like, Philip Roth's Updike's dead, but...
Roth is about to be, I assume.
Yeah, I'm not... I will neither confirm nor deny. But
Philip Roth is actually a program that has been going on for the last 20 years in a facility in Nevada. I like Philip Roth,
But he's a book a year guy.
Yeah.
And nobody says, oi, slow down. The hell with it.
Well, I think so. Look, I mean, Ian McEwan has the same problem. I mean, mm-hmm. He writes sometimes too fast. And I think Philip Roth, he'll have a masterpiece that'll have a clunker.
Did you like On Chesil Beach? Are you a Chesil Beach guy?
I actually like the stuff in the suites, but the rest of it, it would have been, I think, a great short story.
I agree.
And I thought it was padded out needlessly, and he is...
What do you think happened? Do you think his publishers said...
I think...
Let's get this to book length?
What the hell? I'll be point blank. I'm a guy who has every Ian McEwan book, who has read every Ian McEwan book.
Mm-hmm.
His problem... I would say, is that he's too eager to please.
Mm.
His sentences demonstrate this. Mm. He's too slick and clinical sometimes with his sentences. And it's after Atonement. After Atonement, you start to see that he's so eager to please.
Mm. Well, maybe once you've had a taste of that, maybe it's hard to let go. I'll tell you, I think the best advice I ever got was from my agent. I had turned in Good in Bed, and it hadn't been published. And she's like, you start writing your second book right this minute.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to go shopping. I want to go on vacation. And she's like, no. She's like, when your book comes out, there will be readers, and there will be expectations, and there's going to be people who will want the same thing again. And you had better just get that second book done so it's done. So you're not pandering to the audience that liked the first book. She just said, I want you to go write the book that's in your heart and not worry about, is it like the first book I wrote? Is it not like the first book I wrote? Because we didn't know what was going to happen with Good and Bad.
Yeah.
But she just said, if this book comes out and it's a success, it could change the way you write. It could change the way you think about things. So you go do that second book.
Yeah.
And then you go do that third book. And that's what I've done. And I try not to think about the reception.
Yeah.
I do. I mean, I know you're laughing at me because I'm I'm like very up on what's being said.
Yeah, but I mean, you and I are Twitter buddies.
Yes.
I see how you reply so frequently to your readers.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that, you know,
I should just let them be?
Well, I mean, I think it's a very polite thing to do, but I mean, you know, I checked you're doing pretty well on Goodreads. Mm-hmm. A lot of authors can say that, actually.
That's nice.
I mean, no,
I never go there.
I don't check.
And
I feel bad for even mentioning this because
okay.
I know you'll go to it.
No, I won't.
Doing actually all right on there.
Okay.
So I mean, I think that if an author reaches a certain point where they have a track record of success, whether it be critical or commercial, there just comes a point where they shouldn't even bother with this. I mean, you know,
and
that,
just do what you want.
Yes, yeah, David Mitchell, as I was saying earlier, he does not look at his reviews.
Yeah, and I try not to.
Yeah, you try not to. I guess it's doomed. I wanted to go back to what you were saying earlier about gender roles,
yes.
And specifically this idea that women have to please. This is very interesting because I was reading this book, and to me, Ruth was interesting because she requires so much assurance from other people.
Yes.
You know, the demands upon Gary I had mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Her constant refresh of Nikki Fink with every lap.
Poor thing.
Which I don't know if that's autobiographical.
No, I stayed away from Nikki.
Okay.
But god damn, does she know everything.
She does.
She knew my show was canceled before I did.
That's true.
Ouch.
The pleas that Ruth offers in the boudoir late in the book, the character in control giving me what I needed, what I'd never even guessed I needed.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't spoil anything. Why can't Ruth spend more of her time taking charge, saying like, you know, no, you doofus, touch me here.
Touch me here. Women do that.
Now, that's something women do do.
And, that is true.
And it actually results in far more successful sexual relationships or meaningful relationships.
Except I think Ruth is somebody who's very out of touch with her body. Yeah. She doesn't live in her skin. She doesn't know how to say where she wants to be touched.
Yeah.
She has to learn.
Yeah.
And I think she is lucky enough to find a guy who's sort of willing to work with her a little bit on that stuff. But a lot of women, you know, I can't even remember where I read it, but it was sort of like women need to take responsibility for their own orgasm. And like, I believe that, like I really do, because like, if you don't know what you like, how can you tell someone else what's going to make you happy?
But some women don't even get that opportunity, especially if they grow up in a repressed or fundamentalist household.
Exactly. But you know, like, I mean, it goes back to what I said earlier about, like, women are wired to please. Like, you know, and this whole, like, blowjob culture that, like, I don't know if that's really going on. Like, Caitlin Flanagan wrote that, you know, Atlantic thing, and I don't know. Like, my daughters are 9 and 4. Like, they're watching SpongeBob. I don't know what's going on with that. But the notion...
You didn't see the blowjob subplot in SpongeBob.
Sadly, missed it.
It was a really great story.
Yeah, like, what is up with Squidward? I don't know. But, you know, the whole idea of, like, blowjob culture is, like, there's no reciprocity. It's like, you're there to please him, and then just sort of, you know, pat your lips dry and go away.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, in America, there are still... too many women for whom sex is a duty or an obligation or something where you please him. And if you have a good time while it's happening, that's just a lucky happenstance thing.
But it's not just sex. It's also vocationally speaking.
Absolutely.
In this book. I mean, you know, I raise this because, again, what I was saying earlier, that when you depict a woman in a very... one could say limited way, and I know you've depicted women in many other ways too. But I mean, in this case, she's a pleaser.
She's broken, and she's a pleaser.
Yeah, you open yourself up to, again, all the bullshit chick lit shit. You know, all of that nonsense where, you know, which you as you said in your last book, you were trying to counter. No, I am writing about issues and so forth. So do you consider this when you come up with a character like Ruth?
I try not to, you know? I mean, I did want to explicitly deal with the economics of it in Then Came You.
Yeah.
I think with the next best thing, I wanted to tell a story about Hollywood. And maybe the character was a little bit secondary to wanting to talk about the truth of what it's like out there, where you go out there with a vision and it sort of gets chipped away and mitigated and changed and tweaked and rewritten and altered. And maybe the character was slightly secondary to that story. And maybe that was a mistake.
The last time we talked, I urged you in the strongest possible terms not to give a flying fuck about the New York Times book review.
I know. And yet.
Yeah, so you have continued to obsess, but now I come back to you with hard results.
Yes.
All right.
Okay. How are they doing?
So, first off, did you see that Publishers Weekly article that
ran? No. What
they basically said, the New York Times Book Review really is not mattering when it comes to book sales. That at the most, it has moved about 183 copies of one book. That's the best.
Dag.
Now, when you consider, like, say, for example, like what Cheryl Strayed did business by being revealed as the Dear Sugar columnist in the Rumpus,
that's
something to say. The other thing I will say in terms of like the gender gap, well, you know, let's look at the awards. The last two National Book Awards,
women.
8 of the 10 have been women, and women have won for both of them. Mm-hmm. We can mention Jennifer Egan, who has won the Pulitzer and the National Book Critics Circle Award the last time they gave.
And then shit all over chick lit writers.
Well,
thanks.
I know.
Thanks, Jen.
I understand that, but you know, the point I'm trying to make here is that now we have unequivocal evidence that the New York Times Book Review does not matter nearly as much as it perhaps did maybe 15 years ago.
Sure.
So why is this the prism? Why is this the prism for you to kind of look at the gender gap in terms of writing?
You
so
know,
forth?
it's because that's what I grew up reading.
Yeah.
I grew up reading the Times. And I grew up, and I still read their reviews and look to them as sort of the arbiters of books that matter.
Even in our social media Goodreads age?
Yeah. I still read the Times.
Why do they still matter? Why do you think? for you?
You know, I think it's a childhood thing. I think that you stick with what you know, and what I learned sort of at my parents' knees. They read The New Yorker, yeah, and they read The New York Times, and those were sort of the places, you know, Harper's and The Atlantic and The Economist, and that was what was in the house, and that was what I saw, and that was what was viewed as having importance and relevance in, yeah, in my house. So 183 copies, though, man, I got to rethink this shit.
Exactly.
I
came back with some stats this time.
Yes, I love it. I love it.
But this is interesting because you are basing your present, I suppose, literary value.
Uh-huh.
And I'm using that deliberately because I think it's a really stupid, you know,
that's
idea.
Okay. I'm
using that deliberately. You're basing this off of, I suppose, nostalgia to some degree, I would say.
Yeah.
You're basing this off of something that does not reflect the
current
present reality, which is, you know, look, we're all fragmented right now. Books,
absolutely,
culture right now. Last time we talked, we had, you know, we actually had borders.
Yeah.
We are seeing, like, you know, we have ebooks are way different now.
God, I have to tell you, yeah, there's something so weird about, like, being in your publisher's office where they're going through your sales,
yeah,
and it's like, okay, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, iTunes, and there's a blank where borders used to be.
Yeah.
It's just like no more.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing.
So given present cataclysmic events in,
yes,
the publishing scene,
yes,
you know, I'm trying to suggest that maybe your it's like, I think you're getting some literary cred here and there. Look, guys like me, you don't have to worry about.
I appreciate it.
And, you know, there are, and also, like, look at that silly Stephen King article that appeared on the LA Review of Books. This,
yeah,
guy named Alan, and he was totally slammed too.
Yeah.
We're now at a point where we're in almost in a post critical culture, I would say. So as a result,
post critical, or I wonder if it's just that now everyone's a critic.
Perhaps.
Everyone with a laptop and a
Goodreads
account.
Everyone's a reviewer, certainly.
Everyone's a reviewer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It's interesting.
But I'm gonna give that some thought about the times, because I know, I mean, again, I know I keep saying, like, this is how I'm wired, but it is true. Like, that is what I grew up reading. That's the paper that's in my house every morning.
So what would happen,
uh-huh,
if, say, and this would never happen, but what,
right,
would happen if it did happen?
Okay.
Sam Tannenhaus and company, mm-hmm, decide to go ahead and devote a front page review,
right,
to how great Jennifer Weiner is. Would that completely destroy you or devastate you? Or would we fall back and you would look for another target to devote,
oh,
your attention to?
Oh, my God.
I mean,
I hate to think of myself as someone who needs targets. I don't think I'm like that. I hope I'm not.
You did say you need more. Earlier.
Well, more and targets are different.
Yeah, targets. But I think it's safe to say that we've,
uh-huh,
established that your obsession at times with The New York Times comes down to the fact that, well, you know, they haven't really been reviewing my books. You've had issues with their bestseller lists and,
yeah,
so forth. So I know that there's some personal interest to this.
Some personal interest, but I do want to say that it really, really isn't just about me. And I know,
yeah,
people won't believe that. I mean, I know, like, Roxane Gay and I went back and forth. She wrote a piece for Salon,
yes,
that basically said, this is Jennifer Weiner's personal obsession writ large.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? Like, if all I wanted was the Times to review me, wouldn't I be nice to them, like, all the time? Wouldn't I be saying how great they are and, oh, my God, that Janet Maslin piece was fantastic?
Yeah, but you want to be reviewed by the Times. You want to get thoughtfully written about, I think.
I would like to be thoughtfully reviewed. I have sort of given up that it's ever going to happen. But it's not just a question of disrespecting me. I think that, look, when they do roundups of crime fiction, okay,
yeah,
Marilyn Stasio, every Sunday, there's a roundup of books that men will read on airplanes.
Yeah.
Like, let's call them what they are. They're books that men will read on airplanes. There is no parallel document for books that women will read on airplanes. There's nothing about romance. When they write about chick lit, they get it wrong,
yeah,
and they're dismissive and snotty.
They're getting better at YA, however.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know.
Pamela Paul's terrific.
Yeah.
They're very, very good at children's books. And I would say that's another reason the Times matters. Like, I sometimes feel like Pamela Paul is,
yeah,
the only reason I will read the Sunday Times book review so I can get books for my daughters.
Yeah. You take the good.
Yeah.
But then the bad, you obsess over that.
I'm really trying not to obsess.
Yeah.
I just want them to be fair.
Yeah.
you know? And if that makes me obsessed, I guess so be it.
Yeah.
But if my daughters grow up to be writers, I don't want them to have to jump through female-specific hoops to prove that what they've written is worthy of consideration. I don't think books need to come in onesies that are pink or blue. I think books can be books.
Who says they will? I mean, you know, we have seen, I think, I would argue, in the last 10 years, tremendous developments. I mean, I remember the time when if you read, like, a science fiction paper book in certain places, you would be completely looked down upon. Now everyone does it.
Science fiction's gotten better. Yeah. I don't know that women's fiction,
We're getting there.
And I'm pushing. I'm trying. Yeah. I am. I hope I'm doing some good. I hope it's just not, you know, me being unhappy about something.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, well-behaved women don't make history. Like, sometimes you need an unhappy, loudmouth woman. You do.
Okay.
We have a place in the world, Ed.
Well, and so do loudmouth men at that
yes,
point.
Yes, they do.
That seems a good place to end. Jen,
there it is.
As always, it was a pleasure to chat
with
you.
It's always
so
good.
Much.
Smart questions. Thank you. To be the best, we got to pass the test. We got to make it all the way to the